This evening we have with us for the affirmative, that is the principle that Roe v. Wade should be reversed, Mrs. Susie Hohler, who is attorney and represents the Greater Dallas Right to Life, and Dr. Norman Geisler, who is a professor of the Dallas Theological Seminary. Mrs. Hohler and Dr. Geisler are on my right. On my left, speaking on behalf of the negative, that was purely by hazard, and I would point out it's your right. Speaking on behalf of the negative, our Professor Neil Kogan of the SMU Law School. Contrary to what you have read, I would like to point out that Professor Kogan has asked me to state he is not an ACLU attorney, as was carried in some of the advertisements. Also, speaking on behalf of the negative is Ms. Charlotte Taft, who's director of the Root Street Women's Clinic. If both sides are now ready, we will begin the debate with the first affirmative presented by Mrs. Susie Hohler.
Thank you, Dean Salicu. Our position tonight is that Roe v. Wade should be reversed so that the unborn child's right to life can be restored in American law. On January 22, 1973, the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade announced that a new personal liberty existed in the Constitution, the liberty of a woman to terminate her pregnancy at any time in its course. The court struck down as unconstitutional the Texas criminal abortion statute, which prohibited abortion except to save the mother's life. The decision's effect was to overturn the anti-abortion laws in every state. The central truth of Roe is that a woman may at any time during her pregnancy kill her unborn child. The court arbitrarily divided pregnancy into three trimesters and laid down these rules. For the first trimester, abortion is legal for any reason, and the state may not interfere with the woman's physician. In the second trimester, abortion remains legal for any reason, but the state may regulate it to protect the mother's health. For the stage subsequent to viability, the court may prohibit abortion except where necessary to protect the life or health of the mother. The health exception is so broad that it permits abortion for any reason up to the point of birth. The court described health, based on a United Nations definition, as a state of complete physical, mental, and familial well-being, not simply the absence of illness and disease. The court ignored the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which I can't see with those lights, I'm sorry. I can't read my paper. The court ignored the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which provides the child, by reason of its physical and mental immaturity, needs special safeguards and care, including appropriate legal protection before and after birth. I would like now to give several reasons why Roe v. Wade should be reversed. The majority opinion, written by Justice Blackmun, acknowledged that a woman does not have an absolute right to terminate her pregnancy and recognized the state's interest in protecting life. However, abortion on demand has been the result of Roe. Over 1.5 million unborn children are killed by abortion in the United States every year. In Texas, killing by abortion is wide open from conception to the commencement of childbirth. Even where a state tries to prohibit abortion after viability, the health exception is so broad to make such prohibition impossible. The court arbitrarily characterized the unborn child at all stages of development prior to birth as potential life. Blackmun said the court need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins. The court dared not expressly deny that human life begins at conception and is present throughout pregnancy, because that would have been too obvious a biological error in 1973. So Justice Blackmun pled ignorance concerning life in the womb and completely ignored scientific evidence on the characteristics of unborn human life. Science has proven that the unborn child is human, is alive, and has a distinct biological being and genetic code from conception. The biological basis of the personhood of the unborn child has been furthered by recent scientific advances in the treatment of medical problems of the unborn child as a patient in his own right. One does not have to be a scientist or a physician to understand the humanity of the unborn child. Intrauterine photography and sonograms have provided windows on the womb, and we can see the human features and movements of the unborn child in the earliest weeks of pregnancy. Having trivialized abortion by assigning the unborn baby to the netherworld status of potential life, the court held that the unborn child is a non-person and therefore is not entitled to legal protection under the 14th Amendment, which guarantees that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The 14th Amendment to our Constitution does not require birth for personhood status, as personhood is a broad legal concept which, as applied to natural persons, means live human beings. The unborn meet the personhood test because they are living humans with well-established legal status under substantial Anglo-American jurisprudence. To this day, state law has recognized unborn children as persons entitled to a variety of legal rights. They have inheritance rights. They can be represented by a guardian in a court proceeding. Criminals who have assaulted pregnant women have been successfully prosecuted for murder when the unborn child has been killed. Nevertheless, because of Roe v. Wade, the law regards unborn children as non-persons when a mother is willing to destroy her own child. Legal chaos has resulted from Roe v. Wade. A prematurely born child of 7 months gestational age has 14th Amendment protection of its life, while an older and more developed unborn child at 8 months does not. Neither the 5th nor the 14th Amendments to our Constitution, which guarantee the life of all persons, can justify such bizarre discrimination. Medical schizophrenia occurs daily in American hospitals. A 23-week-old child can be lifted alive from her mother's womb and be allowed to die in the process of abortion by hysterotomy, while in the next room, another child who's prematurely born is rushed to an incubator. While liberty is a cherished concept, life is the most basic of rights, for without life, all other rights are meaningless. The Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade gave more weight to a woman's personal lifestyle than it did the right of the unborn child to live. The court characterized the right of abortion as fundamental to our concept of ordered liberty. How could this be when abortion had been a crime for centuries at common law and in all 50 states? Our legal and social heritage prior to 1973 viewed abortion not as a fundamental right, but as a wrongful act. The Constitution protects the life rights of persons, and nowhere does it give any individual the right to destroy another innocent life. The Supreme Court created a new constitutional right to abortion based on the right to privacy. Blackmun, who wrote the decision, conceded that the Constitution does not contain a right of privacy in its text, and he said he wasn't sure where it was found, but they created it nonetheless. Byron Wright vigorously dissented in Roe, saying, "I find nothing in the language or history of our Constitution to support the court's judgment." White characterized the decision as an exercise of raw judicial power and said, "I cannot accept the court interposing a constitutional barrier to state efforts to protect human life and investing mothers and doctors with the constitutionally protected right to exterminate it. This is what a Supreme Court justice said about Roe v. Wade. Recently, our nation has found itself with the most permissive abortion laws in the world. Only after China began a population control program, including forced abortion and infanticide, did we lose that distinction. Thomas Jefferson proclaims in the Declaration of Independence, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, life was first, liberty was second, and the pursuit of happiness was third." The 14th Amendment to the American Constitution guarantees that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Roe v. Wade perverted our Constitution and must be reversed to stop the wanton destruction of innocent human life. It is only potential human life, our opponents will say or would say. We will respond that the only alternative to potential human life is dead human life. Roe v. Wade must be reversed and legal protection restored to uniquely vulnerable members of the human race. Thank you.
Thank you. Speaking on behalf of the first negative is Professor Neil Kogan.
I stand in opposition to the proposition that Roe versus Wade should be reversed. My position is this. The decision by the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade was a conservative decision that protected the fundamental liberty of Americans. A decision to overrule Roe versus Wade would be a radical decision to deny fundamental liberty. The decision in Roe versus Wade was a legal decision. While the law is influenced by political, religious, philosophical, and biological theory and principles, the primary source for any conservative judge deciding law is the law itself, legal decisions. The decision in Roe versus Wade concerned the proper interpretation of one clause of the Constitution found in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, ratified in 1868. That clause is called the Due Process Clause. The Due Process Clause says, "No state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law." The primary legal issues the court had to decide were, one, whether a fetus is a, quote, person, end quote, under the 14th Amendment, and whether a person's, quote, liberty, end quote, under the law includes all safe surgical procedures, including abortion. When life begins was not a primary legal decision for the court, because the Constitution does not protect all life. It only protects the life of a person. The legal issues were decided by 9 justices, 6 Republican appointees, 3 Democratic appointees. 5 of the 6 Republican appointees joined the majority, including both of President Eisenhower's appointees and 3 of the 4 President Nixon appointees. 2 of the 3 Democratic appointees joined the majority, with 1 joining the minority. President Kennedy's 2 appointees split. Thus, the vote was 7-2, with 5 Republicans and 2 Democrats in the majority. The court that decided the issue was and continues to be one of the most conservative courts in the history of the country. On the issue of who is a person under the Constitution, the court said that the Constitution and the law in general had never recognized the unborn as a person and had given only limited protection to a, quote, quickened fetus, end quote. For example, under property law, the unborn are entitled to property rights only if they are born. True, they can be represented, but they are entitled to rights only if they are born, not if they are not born. Under tort law is the law created by the courts over the course of many centuries to give compensation for injuries. Under tort law, the unborn have rights to sue for injuries that occur to them in utero, only if they are born, not if they are not born. Under criminal law, for most of seven centuries of Anglo-American jurisprudence, killing a fetus prior to quickening was not a crime. After quickening, there was a split in the jurisdictions. Some jurisdictions holding that there was no crime, and others holding that there was a misdemeanor. But no jurisdiction, for six of seven centuries, until the middle of the 19th century, had ever held that killing a quickened fetus was murder. A conservative court, deciding conservatively, could only decide, given all of that precedent, that a fetus was not a person when the Due Process Clause came into existence in 1868. Those who argue, and you see them in the press, that we should look at the text and we should look at the intent of the drafters of the text at the time, if the court limits itself to that, would have no choice. The law was clear. A fetus was not considered a person at that period of time. A contrary decision that fetuses are persons under our Constitution would lead, for example, to results such as when the Congress reapportions itself, fetuses have to be counted amongst persons for the purposes of dividing the state, whether they are born or they are not born. It would lead, for example, in property law, to quarrels between children who are born and the estates, presumably represented by some court-appointed lawyer or the state itself, quarrels between children and the estates of miscarried fetuses, and so on. The decision now with regard to the second issue of whether a person's liberty included all safe surgical procedures, including abortion, was a little bit more difficult. But nonetheless, the 7-2 majority's decision was still plainly a conservative decision. The conservative view of liberty was, until recently perhaps, and I'm not sure that it's changed, the conservative view of liberty was that we have the choice of doing with our lives what we please so long as we harm no other person. Put differently, government should not intrude into our private lives unless we harm another person. The Due Process Clause, as I said, was ratified in 1868. In the 1880s, when the court first had the opportunity to look at this clause, the court began to say that liberty included the right to enter into contracts, the right to work. You won't find it in the words of the Constitution. They said liberty included in America the right to contract, the right to work. In the 1920s, the court began to say that liberty included what kind of family we as Americans may have. For example, prior to the decision in Roe, the court said that we as Americans have liberty regarding the family in the following areas: whether to marry or not, whether to use a contraceptive or not, whether to undergo sterilization or not, whether to educate our children in public schools or in private schools, whether to teach our children certain subjects, which the state majority might decide that they don't want taught. But nonetheless, the court said that we have the liberty to so decide for our family. The court decided that this liberty regarding family decisions included abortion in Roe, of course. A contrary decision, or an overruling of the decision, which throws a whole line of liberty decisions decided by the court going back to the 1880s into doubt. Even so, this conservative court said that liberty regarding family decisions stopped at the time of viability of the fetus. This court did not give to women all the liberty they had had for most of the seven centuries of Anglo-American jurisprudence. Those who argue that the Constitution in its words says liberty but not abortion omit the fact that the Constitution does not say that there is a right to work, that there is a right to travel, that there is a right to marry, that there is a right to divorce, conceive, not conceive, sterilize, not sterilize, and so on. All of these matters are matters that the court over the years, going back now almost 100 years, has looked at and has said is part of the fundamental liberty of Americans. Those who argue against liberty, as we have known it for generations and generations, are making the case for Big Brother government. For me, liberty means what it has always meant for generations of Americans, for generations of Texans. In this 150th year of the state of Texas, we should not abandon these traditions of liberty. Instead, we should do what we have always done. Counsel people to use liberty wisely. Teach birth control to our children. I have four. I teach. Make birth control available to those who wish it. Encourage adoption. Support poor families with children. Punish those who commit rape and incest severely. But don't deny liberty.
Norm Geisler.
Moral arguments in favor of abortion are persuasive. First, there is a woman's right to privacy over her own body. Secondly, there are therapeutic situations where abortion is necessary for the well-being of the mother. Third, there is a need to alleviate the insufferable indignity which pregnancy by rape forces upon a woman. Fourth, there are those unwanted pregnancies which make the child vulnerable to neglect and abuse. Fifth, compassion is needed for the thousands of women's lives threatened from illegal abortions by rusty coat hangers in back alleys. Finally, it can be argued, as Roe v. Wade did, that the abortion decision in all its aspects is inherently and primarily a medical decision. I must confess that I find merit in all of these arguments. In fact, they're even persuasive, granting one major assumption which the Supreme Court made. It predicated that the unborn is not truly a human person, but only a potential human life. If the unborn is not an individual human being, but merely a tissue or unnecessary appendix, then the arguments for abortion are convincing. If, on the other hand, the unborn child is truly a human being, then all these arguments turn out to be little more than an emotional appeal without moral justification. For example, who would argue on similar grounds to those used by pro-abortionists that Hitler had the right to kill Jews because they were deformed or undesired? Surely few abortionists believe that an unwed German mother had the right to kill her infant child because she later discovered his father was Jewish. Or what abortionist would insist that because Jews were being killed anyway by rusty knives in back alleys, that this justified passing laws to ensure them a sanitary death by sterile instruments? And surely no reasonable abortionist would insist that the mother of the famous black singer Ethel Waters had the moral right to kill her daughter years after she was born because the mother was yet haunted by memories about the rape by which Ethel was conceived. But why do even abortionists admit that these kinds of killings are obviously wrong and yet insist at the same time that abortion for the same reasons is morally right? The answer is simple. Abortionists do not grant the unborn a human status, and so they believe the prohibition against murder does not apply. On the other hand, as even Roe decision admits, quote, if this suggestion of personhood is established, the appellant's case, of course, collapses, for the fetus' right to life is then guaranteed by the 14th Amendment, end quote. So in the final analysis, there is really only one basic issue. It's not legal, it's not medical, it's moral. Is the unborn a human being? If it is, then Roe v. Wade is allowing unjustified homicide.
in this case, to argue that abortion is essentially a medical decision is as absurd as claiming that capital punishment by the electric chair is primarily a problem of electronic engineering. If we are dealing with a human being, whether in capital punishment or abortion, then intentionally taking their life is a moral issue. And if the unborn baby is human, then the American slaughter of nearly 1.5 million unborn babies a year, over 4,000 a day, one about every 20 seconds, is a major moral issue. Indeed, it is a great American Holocaust. After all, Hitler only killed 6 million Jews. But since 1973, Americans have exterminated over 18 million unborn children in abortion chambers. We must face then the real issue, and we plead with our abortionist friends to do the same. Is the unborn child a human being? The evidence in favor of a positive answer to this question is overwhelming. First, genetically, science has demonstrated that human life begins at conception. All genetic characteristics of a fully developed and distinct individual human being are actually, not potentially, present from the moment of conception on. Gynecologists are thus urged to consider the unborn their second patient. Second, biologically, life is a continuous, uninterrupted flow. At no point does it stop and then several months later abruptly begin. Human life is passed on through conception from parent to offspring without interruption. For when the human sperm unites with the human ovum and forms a separate human zygote, this is a distinct human being. Third, morally we must make the presumption of humanity on behalf of the unborn, for any other assumption necessitates that we define human life in terms which would logically exclude from the human community other minority elements in our society as well. For example, if we define human life of the unborn in terms of its age, so many months in the womb, then why not exclude others from human society such as the elderly because of their age? Likewise, if humanness is defined in terms of the abnormal size, why not exclude midgets or pro basketball centers? Further, every one of us in this room began as a tiny one-cell organism. Furthermore, if humanness is defined in terms of location, that is, outside the womb, then why can't we also discriminate against sections of our society because of their location on the wrong side of the track or in the ghetto? The simple truth is that geography does not determine humanity. Passing through a birth canal does not change one's human status. Or if we define humans in terms of genetic purity, say excluding those with Down syndrome, then other minorities in our society with genetic deformities like sickle cell anemia can also be declared non-human too. And if an individual human is defined in terms of viability, then we must also consider severely injured persons, the infirmed, and any who can't defend themselves to be not human either. Also, if humanness is defined in terms of consciousness, then drunks, sleepers, drug abusers, and even some transcendental meditators are not human. In addition, if personhood is defined in terms of function of self-consciousness, then any child up to the age of 1.5 years of age is a candidate for infanticide. Likewise, if human personhood is defined in terms of ability to think rationally, then we'll have to exclude from the community of humans all young children, those under great emotional distress, and even some mystical states of consciousness. Also, if humanness includes only those who can make moral choices, then young children, the insane, and moral reprobates are not human either. Finally, if we exclude all human beings who are unwanted, then any undesired segment of our society, such as AIDS victims, child abusers, or derelicts, can be disposed of as non-human. Fourth, logically, abortion and infanticide are inseparable. Every good argument for abortion is also a good argument for infanticide. As the abortionist Joseph Fletcher aptly put it, abortion is prenatal euthanasia,
and euthanasia is postnatal abortion. For example, if it's right to kill an unborn child because tests show they may be deformed, then surely it's equally justified to kill them after they are born when we know they are deformed. Fifth, common sense informs us that even if there were some doubt about the human status of the unborn, nevertheless, the benefit of the doubt should be given to the unborn. If we aren't sure whether a body is dead, don't bury it. And if we aren't sure whether what's moving in the bushes is a hunter or a deer, don't shoot it. Let me put the moral argument against abortion in the form of two questions, which I request my abortionist friends to address. One, what evidence do you have the unborn are not really human beings? If the evidence is lacking, then how does abortion on demand differ essentially from infanticide? Two, do incidental matters such as one's size, location, or functional ability exclude them from the human community? If so, then by what logic can we avoid infanticide or euthanasia or other minority groups lacking these same characteristics? If not, then what is your moral justification for killing unborn members of the human community? In summation, let me quote John Donne, the English poet, who said, "Any man's death diminishes me because I'm involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee."
Ms. Charlotte Taft will now speak on behalf of the negative.
I'm going to speak against the overturn of Roe v. Wade, but I want to start my remarks by saying I doubt sincerely that anyone's mind will be changed this evening, even though it's certainly a good idea to have an exchange of ideas. And in fact, the position that I hold, I believe, is the one that not only allows you but encourages you to hold your own belief about this very complex issue. The pro-choice position says that you must look into your own conscience with all the love and caring that you have and make your own decision, and that each person has the right to do that. It would be no more fruitful for me to try to persuade a Jehovah's Witness that he or she was incorrect about the nature of blood products than it would be for me to try to persuade Dr. Geisler that he is incorrect about the nature of the personhood of an embryo or fetus. So I have no intention to try to persuade you that whatever position you hold on this is right or wrong. We've heard several times about restoring personhood to the fetus, and I think it is useful to remember, as Dr. Kogan pointed out, that law in the United States and in other countries, even law that makes abortion illegal, is not based on the personhood of the fetus. I know of no nation in the world today in which illegal abortion is based on that concept. We also know that life begins before conception. If there is no life in the sperm and no life in the egg, there can be no conception. So we're really talking about issues that are even more complicated than the question of conception. Over 60% of conceptuses never are even coming to known pregnancy. So for whatever reason, fertilized eggs are occurring which are not implanting on the wall of the uterus. If that is personhood, then I think we should ask theologically, why would whatever entity believe in cause these persons to come into being and cause them then to be discarded? Some things that we know about abortion. Over 80% of abortions are done in the first trimester of pregnancy. At that time, abortion is about 8 to 10 times safer than going through a full-term pregnancy and significantly safer than illegal abortion. There are over 40 million women in the United States today who have chosen abortion, one out of four of us. We are moral agents who have done our best to make difficult decisions that affect our lives, the lives of our families, the lives of our friends. The majority of Americans, I think, believe that abortion should be a matter of personal choice, While most Americans do not like abortion, I don't know anyone who does. They also feel that it should not be illegal in all circumstances. About 18% of Americans believe abortion should be illegal in all circumstances. Imagine if a list were published of all the women in Dallas who have had an abortion, or even considered one, or a list of all the men involved in a personal relationship which could have led to a considered abortion. The list would be a long and interesting one. Multiply that list by all the communities, large and small, in which women have exercised the right to choose, and you will have a list that includes all kinds of people in all kinds of places. I think it's time to stop apologizing for people who are doing their best with their moral decisions, even if their decisions are not the ones that you yourself would make. It is clear that medical science, psychology, philosophy, and even theology cannot give us an answer to the question of the nature of fetal life any more than they can tell us whether an acorn is an oak tree. Many of the anti-abortion arguments have been made by right-wing religious groups who have sought to intervene in private decisions in a number of areas, while at the same time proclaiming that they want to get government off our backs. What could be bigger government than the government that determines those most private and personal decisions for you? We are aware that the Catholic hierarchy, although unable to condemn war in every circumstance, has found it easy to condemn abortion in every circumstance. They have stated that the fertilized egg is equivalent to a person, even when it is microscopic. Actually, they have sought legislation which would have given a fertilized egg status within the United States Constitution, which women have not managed to achieve. It's no coincidence that those who oppose abortion and birth control are more concerned about the life of the fetus often than they are with the nature of the life of women. I believe that the fetus, the embryo, the fertilized egg, has intrinsic value and is a miraculous process that starts with the joining of the fertilized egg, the joining of the egg and sperm. But the wonder of that must be also tempered by the understanding of what human beings actually deal with in their lives and what we want to expect for children when they are born. Because we believe in religious liberty in this country, it is especially frightening to imagine that the government would put into place as law the perspective of a minority of the nation with regard to religious view of the embryo or fetus. How would this protect the rights of the majority to exercise their religious beliefs? We must always protect the minority from forced abortion. In China, I believe that there is pressure on women to terminate pregnancies because of the population problem they have in that country, and I believe that that is a terrible problem. In Romania, women are by law required to have 4 children, and I believe that that is a terrible problem. I am grateful to live in a country in which I have the right to make a personal decision about questions of birth control and abortion. The Supreme Court decision in 1972, which made birth control legal for unmarried persons, was a Massachusetts case called Baird versus Eisenstadt. In that, the court declared, "We recognize the right of the individual, married or single, to be free from unwarranted governmental intrusion into matters so fundamentally affecting a person as the decision whether to bear or beget a child." In Roe versus Wade, a year later, the Supreme Court restated that concept and added a sentence, "That right necessarily includes the right of a woman to terminate her pregnancy." So the right of us as Americans to use birth control is closely linked to our right to terminate our pregnancies if we so choose. If a fertilized egg is a person, then the most commonly used methods of birth control in this country today, the birth control pill, low dose, and the intrauterine device would have to be outlawed because they interfere with the implantation of the fertilized egg in the wall of the uterus. In the past few years, we have seen this debate about abortion increasingly frustrating to those who oppose abortion. They have not succeeded in changing public opinion on this issue, and more importantly, they have not succeeded in changing public behavior and they have turned more and more often to the violence that we have been somewhat aware of. Death threats, bomb threats. In the past several months, over 7 incidences of bombing and arson that you have not even heard about, including 4 package bombs designed to kill whomever opened them, addressed to clinics in Oregon. When we are dealing with an issue that is as emotional as this, we must find a place of peace. Anti-abortion demonstrators like Joseph Scheidler boast that medical complications to women increase when they picket outside of clinics. Such is the love that they have to offer. There is a terrible danger of polarization of the issues. Polarization does not allow for examination of the complexity of an issue. Abortion is not the right decision for every woman in every circumstance, but it must be an option because it is not the wrong one either. If we are to live our lives as moral beings, we must exercise our consciences. Blind obedience is not morality, it is just conformity. Perhaps we should invite only those who have never made a mistake or faced a complicated moral issue or have never missed the mark, as the Hebrew is for sin, to show us what path to take. But as long as we remain a free society, we must preserve our right to choose whether and when to become parents. We must all work toward a world in which every child born is welcome and nurtured, and which we can look forward to peace on all the levels of our lives. I will end with a stanza of a poem from Marge Piercy called Right to Life. I will choose what enters me, what becomes flesh of my flesh. Without choice, no politics, no ethics lives. I am not your cornfield, not your uranium mine, not your calf for fattening, not your cow for milking. You may not use me as your factory. Priests and legislators do not hold shares in my womb or my mind. This is my body. If I give it to you, I want it back. My life is a non-negotiable demand.
We will now proceed to the rebuttal part of the debate. Mrs. Holler will have 5 minutes to rebut.
Thank you. Before I rebut, I just want to say that I repudiate any violence. I believe in nonviolence, and I'm happy that we're here tonight, and I resent it when people that are concerned about human life are characterized as being violent. So I believe in nonviolence, and would repudiate anyone that would do that. It is on the assumption that a fetus does not become a child until it is actually delivered that the whole case for legalized abortion rests. To destroy a developing child in the womb, sometimes as late as 7 months after conception, is considered by some pro-abortionists as an act of compassion. Yet, to destroy the same fetus 2 months later, when it's been born, is in our law called murder. The logical sequence to the destruction of what are called unwanted children will become the elimination of what will be called in the future unwanted lives. We will not allow the old and the infirmed and the handicapped and the ugly to live. We haven't gone that far in America. We've just said that the unborn don't have a right to live. We haven't gone that far. We are headed in that direction. And the only country that has legislated that human life can be destroyed has been Nazi Germany. But we're headed in that direction because the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade talked about meaningful life. They said that the fetus, the unborn child, does not have a right to life because it's not meaningful. This is the quality of life mentality that has infiltrated our society, so that we look at social and moral issues, which are difficult, but we place them above the fundamental human right to life. I'd like to rebut a few things that Professor Kogan said about the historical American law. In 1741, the city of New York passed